And Smashville, good morning, and thank you for joining us. It is Morning Drive off and running here on this Friday, ESPN 102.5 The Game. We are broadcasting live from Kitchen Notes inside of the Omni Nashville Hotel. Nick Hale, Braden Gall, and the constable, Chase McCabe. He's back in the Game Nashville studios, presented by Wholesale, Inc. Mount Juliet, one more day, no D-Mace. He'll be back on Monday. Boys, happy Friday. We made it.
I love Fridays. That's all.
Cool.
I'm a fan of Fridays. Hey, Chase McCabe Show, 9 a.m. tomorrow. I'm going to do that all day.
Oh, golly. Over-under was like 38 seconds.
Wow. 601.
Not even a minute.
Not even 601 on a Friday.
We
are promoting the return of the constable program.
Chase, go ahead. Tell us segment by segment what the plan is.
I'm not going to spoil the surprise, but.
No, okay.
You know.
Have you written out your teases yet?
No, I have not done that.
Okay. I'm just checking. Might want to get on that. It's very important.
I'm going to do that after this show.
Yeah. So, we've had a lot of Predators games at Bridgestone Arena in the month of February. Going into last night, they had lost three in a row in their own barn. But that is no more, Braden Gall, because last night they came out, skated hard, skated fast, a very solid game. A very positive performance. 3-1 win. And I said yesterday, it felt big. It felt like they had to have this game. I think they realized it. They executed. And they got the all-important 2 points last night.
Yeah, and certainly sort of a different stylistic matchup than you're used to when you play a team like Montreal with a Shea Weber. You're going to play a team that plays a different style than maybe some of these up and down teams like a Vegas or whatever in the Western Conference. And so to show that you can play a grind it out. And it's an example of two great goaltenders playing at a high level. It's one of those where pitching duel, a 1-0 pitching duel or a low scoring defensive game in the NFL where it can still be high level, right? Two teams that are in the playoff race, two goaltenders that are just at the top of their sport and two pretty good teams. And you saw a battle for most of the first two periods, and then of course the new guy Brian Boyle gets on the board with some excellent work in the offensive zone. Not exactly where he's accustomed to scoring, a slap shot from the high slot, not normally where he's going to be putting the puck in the net, but does an excellent job. Great celebration, the building goes nuts for the new guy getting the goal, and frankly they in theory didn't need Jofa to win the game. The Arvidsson goal becomes the third goal, not a game-winning goal. In theory, they didn't need Jofa scoring last night. So some level of secondary scoring there does help them out. And as two guys not on the first line get goals. But Pekka Rinne, and I think Brian Boyle said as much in his post-game interview. He said, listen, Pekka was the first star, and he was just a fantastic showing. I just thought it was a workmanlike performance. Like you go up against a team that sort of wants to grind it out a little bit. And you play their game because you're okay with that. Your goaltender plays great. You pick up two critical points. You're about to go on a road trip against two critical games. I thought that was a really good, hard-fought 2 points last night for the Predators in a spot that they had to have it.
Absolutely. Pekka Rinne stops 34 of 35 shots. Victor Arvidsson, I mean, are we at a point now, and we'll get more to him specifically in the next segment, but I swear to God, it's like he scores every single night. I might go to the Nashville T-shirt company. I forget the name of the company here. That
Project 615.
I don't know if it's probably.
That's my T-shirt company.
Okay, so we're gonna go there, and I want to print graphics with his face on the front, and him missing a few teeth, and then on the back, I want to have death, taxes, RV goals. I swear, since December 31st, I mean, I know he's the leading goal scorer in the league, but it seems like he scores every single night.
So I like your concept. I think we can work. We could tweak the execution a little bit. I like the idea. I think it's like death, taxes, and hustle.
Yeah,
and maybe it's what it needs to be. Like we can refine the language a little bit to make it a hot commodity. But no, you know how you see the caricature of like the guy with no face but the beard, right?
Mm-hmm.
All you see is like the outline of a guy's face, and it's the beard. And I can't remember whose shirt that's supposed to be, but you know, death, taxes, and hustle, and it's just like a mouth with like four teeth missing on the front there, and he's a little bit shorter than everybody else. I love his celebrations too. Like he always just is, you know, every shift he's exploding with energy. Late in the game, they got caught on a couple of icing calls, and he had been just busting his tail for the whole shift, and he has to stay on the ice. and he still plays with 100% effort. Like, even though he's, like, literally huffing and puffing mm-hmm. to get back down the ice, to get back in position, he still plays the next shift with a ton of energy. So he is the Energizer Bunny, whatever cliche you want to use. It's just so much fun to watch him play. And like you said, we'll get a little bit more into the actual scoring numbers. But I thought last night the fact that you didn't need Jofa, they did get on the board late with a great goal, and it continues their point sort of, you know, compilation here. But they didn't need it in theory. Pekka was great, and the first two goals came from other lines, from other players.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Kyle Turris, for the love of God, still only gets himself like two chances a game, and he doesn't put anything in. Like, Kyle Turris has still got a long way to go. Kevin Fiala, I thought last night, flashed a little bit, had a few shots on goal that were really good opportunities, just couldn't put it in. But the Ryan Hartman goal was spectacular, and then Brian Boyle doing what he did. So really cool to see the new guy get on the board there. And then Ryan Hartman, 27 games without a goal.
Mm-hmm.
He had to break that streak at some point. He literally skates back to the bench and pulls the monkey off his back. So,
and this will set up a big one tomorrow night in Vegas as the Preds take on the Las Vegas Golden Knights, 9 o'clock local time here. But last night, really, actually a double dip of positivity. Not only do the Predators win and get 2 points, but Winnipeg continues to be kind of stuck in neutral. They lose to Colorado 4-1. The Jets now 5-5-1 in their last 11 games. And I'm starting to wonder, and I know we're in the, quote, dog days of February, we're in retirement month for NHL players, but it's almost as if with both the Preds and the Jets, you wonder, first of all, you feel like if the Winnipeg was able to play much better, they might have put the Preds out of commission for winning the Central this month. But I almost want to ask both teams, does anybody really want to win this Central Division? Because it's there for the taking if anybody can get hot.
Yeah, I mean, you're right about that, but they're still pretty good teams. That's what's, again, this is one of the most complicated things to understand about this Preds team is that, you know, we have a lot of complaints, right? We have a complaint about the power play. We've got a complaint about secondary scoring. We don't see the rhythm at all. But now they're just two points back of, mm-hmm. of Winnipeg and a couple points back of the West, which is the same stinking line we've been saying over and over again. This is a really, really good team. They've got lots of good players and in critical spots, too. So they're good enough to go on a deep playoff run. And I think fans would be disappointed if they didn't. But you're right. It's all it takes is a 3 or 4 game streak here for one of these two teams to either Winnipeg to pull away or for Nashville to leapfrog them and take control of the division.
615-737-1025 is our number. 615-737-1025. If you want to climb in on the Preds conversation, you can, of course, follow us and tweet us at 1025_MD. So here's what we got coming up this morning on the show. A lot of Preds. We're also going to get to the Vols. Big matchup tomorrow night against Kentucky. Josh Ward at 6:30. And then we will get to Teron Davenport and Terry Crisp in the third hour of the show. One of the things that I do want to get to, we didn't have a lot of time to react to it yesterday. We had Darren Drager on from TSN, and we were talking all things Preds with him, NHL trade deadline. And Drager said something very interesting on the show yesterday. This was Darren Drager's response to where he stands in regards to acquiring a rental player that maybe would not re-sign here in Nashville. Take a listen.
Well, some of these players help. There's no doubt of that. I'm reminded of Paul Stastny last year, you know, acquired by the Winnipeg Jets. And, you know, he helped the Winnipeg Jets, and they tried desperately to try and extend him, and it didn't work out. Obviously, he's moved on, and the Winnipeg Jets didn't win a Stanley Cup. So your point is well made. I would be very hesitant if I were a manager to pay the asking price of some of these rentals. And, you know, I guess it's a little bit unique this year when you look at some of the names. You know, again, if we're talking about Mark Stone or Matt Duchene, these are high quality rentals here. And, you know, it depends on the team that is most interested and willing to pay the price to acquire that player. I can tell you guys this. I mean, Nashville, as an example, has always been, well, always in the last 5+ years, has been a destination of choice for players. So, you know, if you're David Poile and you want to get into the big game hunting, you acquire one of those pieces like a Matt Duchene, I feel like there's a decent chance that you're going to be able to extend them. It might get more difficult from a salary perspective, given everything that you've got, but it depends on the team that we're talking about when it comes to the gamble of acquiring a rental player.
So there you go. That's Darren Drager's take from TSN. It'll be interesting to see just how aggressively David Poile and probably even Winnipeg at this point pursue some of these high-priced free agents on the fact that, you know, they could very well just be rentals for 6 weeks.
Yeah, and I, you know, listen, I think I've, you guys know where I stand. It's about the extension for me. I'm willing to part with future positive quality assets like Elie Tolvanen or draft picks or Fabreau, or who now looks like he's got a little bit more value because it looks like Dante Fabreau might be inclined to sign with an NHL team, which makes him more, a more valuable trade chip. So I think I'm okay with parting with the big name to get the big player, but I want it to, you guys know where I draw the line. If you're not going to extend, I don't want to mortgage the future for 19 games because history has shown us that that does not work.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the time doesn't work. 2 out of 29 times the team that did that won the cup.
And yeah, those aren't good odds.
27 out of 29. I'm not good at math, but that's not good.
Mm-hmm.
If you're talking about an extension, though, with a player who could be part of the future, even if it's just two more seasons, let's say, two seasons, and then, you know, the 20 games here and then the postseason, I'd be fine with that because that's in the window and that makes you better next year and the year after. That's sort of where I draw the line. And I think he makes an interesting point about once players come here, and I think you saw it with Brian Boyle last night in his just appreciation of the situation, that the fans, the city, the organization, David Poile, the locker room, I think all of that sells itself to some degree. And so I think there are other things on David Poile's plate he's got to handle, whether it's Kevin Fiala, Colton Sissons, Ryan Hartman, a lot of guys he's going to have to sign. As Darren Draeger said, like, the money could be a problem. You're going to have to work all that out, and that's for smarter people to figure out than us. But at the end of the day, there's a better chance that you re-sign when you're in Nashville than if you get traded to, I don't know, Calgary. I don't know. I don't know how much players want to be in Calgary. It's a great place great fans, all that stuff. But
mm-hmm.
people come to this building and this city and this organization, and they love it and they want to stay. I would assume they would re-sign Brian Boyle, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So if they can get a guy that they're going to re-sign, I'm all for going in. But otherwise, I think there's a lot to like about this team personnel-wise. They just need to play like it.
Mm-hmm. 615-737-1025, our number, 615-737-1025. When we come back, we'll take your Preds calls if you want to chime in. But also, Victor Arvidsson closing in on history. And it needs to be addressed. It needs to be talked about. Nobody is making news of what Victor Arvidsson is closing in on. We'll get into that next. Live from Kitchen Notes, the Omni Nashville Hotel, Nick Braden and the Constable here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. All right, welcome back into Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Nick Hale, Braden Gall, the Constable Chase McCabe. We are broadcasting live from Kitchen Notes inside of the Omni Nashville Hotel. Well, Braden and I are broadcasting live this morning. The Constable's back in the studio.
About to go make a biscuit run here, Constable.
Yep.
I don't know how you feel about that.
You know, I'm very happy for you guys. I hope that you have a wonderful day and enjoy your biscuits.
Just making sure.
That almost was Constable Contemplation-esque with just the tone in his delivery.
Well, look, yesterday we kind of addressed it, and I admitted that I had been a little pissy lately, and so I'm trying to be nice.
I think everyone is entitled to having those types of days.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a tough world we live in. We all have problems and issues, past the tissues, and I think I think you're entitled to that, Chase. You work very hard. You're a very nice guy. You're a good boss.
Thank you. It's very nice.
You got nice lettuce. I mean, you do great post-game interviews. Is there anything left on the table that I've missed?
Yeah, you didn't mention the Chase McCabe show tomorrow 9 to 11. It's been like 11 minutes since we talked about it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for bringing that up.
Let's just promote it every segment.
It's been
please
a reset.
All right. Let's get to Victor Arvidsson, a guy that I said about a month ago on this show when we were doing some second half of the season predictions. I said that Victor Arvidsson would end up being the leading goal scorer on this team, and it would not be Philip Forsberg. And he's taken it a step further, Braden Gall, because he is knocking on the door of Predators history.
Yeah, it's actually quite remarkable. He picks up his 26th last night at the to make it 3-1 and sort of put the game out of reach. So not a game-winning goal, but obviously an important tally last night, which puts him on pace for, if my math is correct, 59 goals. His current 82-game pace is a 59-goal pace, which is just incredible, which means he's going to score probably 15. He's on pace to score at least 15 more goals this season, which would give him 41 goals for the season, which I don't know if you guys know much about the history of the Predators, but Philip Forsberg and I believe Jason Arnott are tied for the franchise lead with 33 goals. He would have done – he could score 41 – again, on pace to score 41 goals in 58 games should he play every game the rest of the season. And that would be, without question, the greatest goal-scoring season by a Nashville Predator ever.
Mm-hmm.
And every team, every time you watch the game, they flash a graphic like he's leading the NHL in goals scored since X date, you know, like – 14 goals over his last X amount of games. I mean, all the stats are up there on the screen. And you just go, I mean, Chase, I don't know about you, man. You could chime in here. I cannot remember a player on a hotter goal-scoring streak. And we've seen Forsberg go on some massive streaks. Was it the back-to-back hat tricks?
Yeah.
A couple years ago. But that comes in a bunch, and you have two or three great games. This has been a 15 or whatever it is, 15-game just absolute tear. And if he continues on this pace, which is unlikely, but it's very possible, if he continues on this pace, he only needs 7 more goals to set a franchise record, and he's played in basically half the games.
Well,
it's really impressive.
I can't think of another streak for a Predator in their history like this, but really, if you look at his entire body of work this season, you know, before the injury, he was on a blistering pace. So the injury kind of derailed that. But if he hadn't gotten hurt, I mean, what would he have already broken the record by now? I think he probably would have.
And that's what's really crazy to think about, is that he could have broken the record like a week and a half ago and had 25 or 30 games. Again, he's on a 60-goal pace,
so
which is double the pace of anybody else who's ever played for the Predators.
So he's on pace for 41 goals this year. If it was an 82-game pace, it would be 59. Now, how many games? Because you said Forsberg had 33. How many games did Forsberg play that year when he scored 33? Do we know?
Yeah, I mean, I can
check. Hang on.
I mean,
he didn't
miss like 20 games that year.
No. He would have played in most of the games.
Probably at least 75 games.
I can check real quickly here, but it's not – I mean, his goal totals were 82 games, 26 goals when he first had his first
full
season.
He played 82 games.
The year he scored 33, he scored 31 goals in 82 games. He had 26 goals in just 67 games last year, so he would have had another 30-goal season. And, again, this year he's already missed about 20, roughly 7. He's missed 17 games this year.
Mm-hmm.
Probably would have gotten to 30 this year had he stayed healthy.
Well, he's still got time to get to 30.
To get there. Do what?
He's still got time.
Yeah, he's still got an outside shot. If he has to go, you know, one goal every other game, which Philip Forsberg is certainly capable of. But, again, all of Philip Forsberg's great, phenomenal, amazing scoring, goal-scoring tactics, and he's the best goal scorer in franchise history probably. I mean, all of that, it pales in comparison to what Victor Arvidsson is accomplishing right now. And I just don't – we all love Victor Arvidsson. We all root for him. We recognize how important he is, and he's the straw that stirs the drink and all this stuff. I still don't think from a statistical standpoint people are appreciating, because, again, it's not just Predators stuff he's leading right now. Predators records he's challenging.
Mm-hmm.
He's ahead of everyone in the NHL over a certain period of time since he came back. He's leading the league in goals. So he's on an absolute tear. And again, if he continues this for just a couple of more weeks, he doesn't even have to get – like, he's on pace for 40-plus goals. All he's got to do is get to 34, and that by definition makes it the greatest goal scoring season in Predators history. So I mean, it's remarkable what he's doing. Basically, on every shift, you're sitting there going, "There's a chance they're going to put one in," and that's how good Jofa's playing right now.
And I'm glad you mentioned Jofa, because it's almost unfair to Victor Arvidsson that his skill kind of gets overlooked because he plays on such a gifted and skilled line with Forsberg and Johansson. And we see Arvidsson, and Crispy calls him the little fella, and, you know, he's always crashing to the net. He's got zero fear. I mean, this is not just a guy who produces because of his effort. This is a guy who produces because, you know what, he's got some skill and some elite-level ability as well. Like, he's not, like, Forsberg, Johansson elite, but he's not just a grinder who scores because he outworks people.
Right.
He's got some skill.
And what's funny is, and this is not like a knock on you, but I think you have gone through like the Victor Arvidsson experience as a fan and a media analyst. You come in, you see him play for the first time, and he doesn't stand out to you as a physically imposing player, mm-hmm. as a guy who looks like he's got, you know, all this overt talent. He's a guy that wasn't a first-round draft pick. And you kind of come into the market and you see that line and you go $8 million center who's 6'4" and best player on the team in Philip Forsberg and then that and the other little guy that just likes to hustle. And I think that's the – because he has that, like, brand, when you're new to the team and you watch the team for the first time and you cover the team for the first time, you see him and it takes you a little while to go, no, wait a second, this guy's more than that. I think that's the evolution that everybody has with Victor Arvidsson. They always land – they always go through that – they land on that phrase, he's more than just mm-hmm. this guy that plays on a great line who works really hard. He is extremely gifted and talented. Johansson, by the way, picks up a couple of – or picks up some numbers. He's up to 42 assists on the season, which puts him almost into top 10 territory. He's one assist away from being top 10 as far as a single season for the Preds. So he's got a chance to break Paul Kariya's assist record. He only needs 12 more of those to break that record. So even in a season that's herky-jerky and up and down and not first place and injury-riddled and all this stuff, we could be watching what could end up being the mm-hmm. best goal-scoring season in Predators history and very possibly Ryan Johansson breaking Paul Kariya's assist record as well. Oh, by the way, with the best defense core and maybe the best goaltender in the league as well. Oh, by the way.
Yeah, and I think Johansson he needs to get his due as well because he's been the one consistent guy night in and night out that's been available on the Joff line. Arvidsson missed 17 games. Forsberg's missed a handful of games. You mentioned all the production from Johansson with the assists and closing in on Kariya, but he's been there night in and night out. And I remember last year, we talked about it in February, March, April, before the playoffs. When are we going to get Ryan Johansson on a consistent night in and night out basis, not just in big moments and big stretches? He's been a dependable guy basically all season.
He's been the most dependable guy all year.
Yeah, no question. I mean, he's got an assist in 6 of the last 8 games. He scored 2 goals during that span. He's got 5 assists in the last 3 games. Now, I know they lost 2 of those games, but mm-hmm. he's got 5 assists in the last 3 games. He picked up another one last night. Obviously, the beautiful pass to Arvidsson across the crease, which seems to be what he's doing quite well these days, is just find Arvy on the back of the net and on the backside of the net, and he'll put it home. So, yeah, I mean, listen, there's a lot to like about this team. Through all of the things that we talk about that are negative, that we need to be addressed, that we're concerned about, that are real issues, and they talk about it on the broadcast even, when they're like, listen, secondary scoring's a thing. It's a problem. The power play's a thing. It's a problem. The inconsistency's a thing. Playing down to the competition, it's a problem. They still have one of the best lines in all of hockey. They have one of the best goaltenders in all of hockey, and they've got one of the best defense corps in all of hockey. They have a very good chance to win some playoff games.
Okay, tomorrow night the Preds take on Vegas in Vegas at 9 o'clock. But before that, how about this for a double dip of sports in Tennessee? You will get the Vols and the Wildcats, Rupp Arena. We're going to head up to Knoxville coming up next to talk to Josh Ward from WNML, get his perspective on the big showdown tomorrow night, the Cats and the Vols. We're talking about that next here on Morning Drive on ESPN 102.5 The Game. ESPN 102.5 The Game. We are broadcasting live this morning from Kitchen Notes inside of the Omni Nashville Hotel. Nick Hale, Braden Gall, and the Constable Chase McCabe. And let's get ready to talk some Vols and Cats. You can hear Tennessee, Kentucky on 94.9 Game 2 starting at 5:30 tomorrow night as we welcome in Josh Ward from WNML in Knoxville. Josh, good morning. How are you?
Hey, great.
So let's get into this game a little bit. I want to attack it from the coaching aspect first. We know Rick Barnes' shortcomings in the tournament. I'm wondering if you're getting the sense, and you talk to Vols fans and you've got the pulse in Knoxville as good as anybody, if Tennessee were to lose tomorrow night at Rupp Arena, are the Rick Barnes detractors going to come out of the woodworks and point out the coaching deficiency or, you know, the coaching aspect of coming up small in big spots? Is that a thing if the Vols lose tomorrow night?
I don't think that is right now. If Tennessee loses, it's the first time in 20 games with the 19-game winning streak going in. And right now, the level of popularity for Rick Barnes and really everybody associated with Tennessee basketball right now is at such a high level. If Tennessee goes up to Rupp and loses, I think fans are going to be understanding and recognize that going there, even though LSU went and won earlier this week at Rupp Arena, that it's just so difficult to do. And I think a lot of the conversation would immediately turn to, okay, we'll get him back here in Knoxville in a couple of weeks. Now, if Tennessee were to get swept by Kentucky, I think that would create more frustration and a little anxiety headed toward the postseason, because if Tennessee's swept by Kentucky, then Tennessee's probably not winning the SEC title, at least not outright. And for a lot of people, that would be disappointing considering the current situation with that winning streak, with an 11-0 record in SEC play. And fans are very optimistic going into this game this weekend, and they should be. Look at what Tennessee's done. But I think if Tennessee comes up short, that a lot of people will understand why, because that is a really difficult game Tennessee's about to go play.
All right, more important matchup, Josh. I know P.J. Washington did a pretty good job on Grant Williams in Knoxville last year, holding him in check for the 20-something minutes he was in the game because he got into foul trouble. But when he was there and the two of them went head-to-head, P.J. Washington played pretty well against the SEC, SEC Player of the Year. So that's a huge matchup. But also Ashton Hagans is a kid who has been known to turn the ball over. He's not scoring a lot. He's not producing a lot as far as creating offense in the last couple of weeks. What's the more important matchup? The very efficient Jordan Bone at point guard going up against a good defensive player, maybe attacking him on defense because Hagans turns the ball over? Or is it about Williams and Washington? Which one are you more interested to watch, and which one has a bigger impact on the game?
Yeah, I'm going to say point guard. I'm going to see how Jordan Bone plays, because he's been terrific this season. And I think he's as big of a reason as anybody on Tennessee's team for why Tennessee has risen to this level. Grant Williams was the SEC Player of the Year last year. Admiral Schofield took a huge step from where he was as a sophomore to a junior last season. I think the development of Jordan Bone, and it is everybody, but Bone especially, has helped Tennessee get to this level, because I think when Bone has been at his best, he's been the best point guard in the SEC, or at least it's difficult to top that performance. And his passing ability, his ability to set players up, they're all really good in that. That's probably an underrated part of Grant's game, because we look at points and rebounds so quickly. But I think the confidence that the coaching staff has in Jordan Bone has been a big deal. So on the road against a younger player who's, I'm sure, fired up to show that maybe he's the best at that position in the SEC, turnovers, points in transition, those are things that can really matter if we're talking about a game that could come down to the last couple of minutes, that could come down to a bucket or two, taking care of the basketball or forcing mistakes on the other side. Either way, that could matter for both of these teams. And after the South Carolina game, Tennessee won by 12 points the other night, and a lot of the questions were about three-point defense by Tennessee. And Rick Barnes said that transition defense was a little more of a concern for him. So that's something I think that comes into play when we talk about guard play in this game against Kentucky.
We're talking with Josh Ward, WNML in Knoxville. Josh, Tuesday night we saw Kentucky lose at the buzzer by 2 points. Duke made a monster comeback against Louisville, a 35-10 run to win and close things out on the road. From a Vols perspective, did you learn anything about Duke and Kentucky in relation to Tennessee when it comes to matchups and just where Tennessee would fit in and how they would match up against these blue blood programs with five-star after five-star recruit?
Yeah, I think Tennessee matches up really well because of the growth of the different players at different positions that we've talked about. Like Kyle Alexander, his development the last few years, he's gone from a guy that at times Tennessee would put him out there on the floor and they would try to figure out in the first couple of minutes if he was somebody that could even help. Now he's a guy that they rely on, and that's more length around the basket. Now, it's difficult to say you love anybody's matchup against Duke, especially if they're on like they were in that final stretch or how they played against Virginia, just because of that physical talent. But I don't think Tennessee backs down in that regard at all. And Tennessee does, Grant Williams, he's not a guy that when he shows up, you look at him and say, okay, there's an NBA power forward. But he does have more length than his height would show, plenty of strength. And Jordan Bowden coming off the bench, he's a guy that has a really good chance to be the SEC sixth man of the year. The depth that Tennessee has as well, I think, can help in matchups like that, in that they can have five or six guys go out there, and Tennessee's confident that they can get double digits. Against South Carolina, Grant Williams had the sixth most points. He had 7 assists. So they have players that can do different things. They're very smart defensively. So against a team like Duke, I'm fascinated by the idea of the matchup, because you have all that talent, and it's a collection of young talent. four players who could be top 15 picks maybe in the NBA draft who are freshmen, and then Tennessee is a team that has grown and developed. And I think the conversation is similar with Kentucky. One reason I like Kentucky's chances, at least to win the SEC this year, was that P.J. Washington came back, and I liked his talent. So, you know, for Kentucky, a sophomore almost is a veteran for that team. But with the other players who have come in, they have plenty of athleticism. And Admiral Schofield the other night really praised the way that they've grown very quickly. You remember that Duke game for Kentucky. If they were to play again, it's a different kind of game for sure, talking about the Wildcats and Blue Devils. So I think Tennessee has a great amount of respect for what Kentucky is, and I do too. I despite the result against LSU, I think Kentucky's a really good team.
Yeah, and I like what Louisville did to Duke. They went to their size down low, and it worked in the first, whatever, 30 minutes or so. Just didn't pan out in the end against Duke. And I find it interesting, Josh, when you look at Tennessee and their size and the length. And listen, they're going to be tested. They've got LSU with a lot of potential NBA athletes. You got size in Mississippi State. You got two against Kentucky. So they're going to be tested in that department. Obviously, Gonzaga and Kansas earlier in the season. Here's my question. Is this just a race to the one line, to the one seed in the committee's mind between Kentucky and Tennessee? Does it – all the championships matter, the SEC, the tournament, and all that stuff is really important. It's a nice banner you hang. But at the end of the day, isn't the most important thing where these two teams stack up against each other in the committee's mind at the end of the year? Is that not what's going to get Tennessee either a one seed or a trip to a Louisville regional? Is that not what we're focused on now the last seven games?
Yeah, I think that's the biggest part of it. And I think what happens when we have this conversation at this point of the year, I'm talking to you from Knoxville. It's still a football town. I think the battle of the polls right now, there's talk, is Tennessee or Duke more deserving of being number one? And that is great for conversation. And we talk about it on my show here, of course. But in terms of what Tennessee's trying to do, that doesn't mean anything. It doesn't matter who's number one or number two in the polls. And when we get to the tournament, which team is number one overall or number two overall for that conversation, that doesn't mean anything either. We're still talking about one seed. And that's what Tennessee's trying to hold on to. And I still think splitting with Kentucky, that would give Tennessee a really good chance, as long as it's able to hold steady. It can maybe stand another loss and still be fine in that conversation. And Tennessee has a really tough schedule. They have to go to Ole Miss. They have to go to LSU still. Mississippi State and will be a tough game. Auburn's on the road to close out the regular season. So there are more games than Kentucky, but Kentucky's probably the team that Tennessee, or one of them, that Tennessee's trying to battle against, and you're going to have at least two head-to-head games to say something there. So, yeah, with all this conversation, I think that where you're playing, the matchups you're going to have in the NCAA tournament, that's all going to matter so much more than who's number one in the middle of February. Again, it's great for conversation, but in terms of what Tennessee's trying to do, which is win an SEC outright title for the first time in more than a decade and try to get to the Final Four for the first time ever, none of the polling and none of the conversation that we're having right now really matters for what they're trying to do.
All right, Josh, last one here. Let's really go into the moral conversation, the ethical conversation, and the, what's right and wrong in life, Josh, and how calling players on another team may not be right or wrong, but it's within the rules. So I know Tennessee fans don't care that Jeremy Pruitt's calling Missouri players to come play for Tennessee. How do you feel? Take Tennessee and Missouri out of it. How do you feel about one coaching staff calling and recruiting players who are currently on a roster at another school and trying to convince them to come play? Is the risk and the reward there? Is the bad PR going to be there? Like, how do you make that whole situation? I think all's fair in love and Cruton, and this sort of counts in Cruton. So I don't know where you fall on this.
Yeah, I don't know that either side is necessarily wrong in it. It did stand out to me, though. Obviously, it did here in Knoxville. But there are several schools who have called and who have recruited, it appears. But there was only one school that was called out. So there had to be a difference to Barry Odom in what Tennessee's done and what other schools have done. And I really would have liked to have been there for the luncheon on Wednesday. But yeah, I think everybody would have. But I don't know that anybody's necessarily wrong. I would also say this on the Tennessee side. Don't you need to land somebody? I mean, if you're going to get called out for how hard you are recruiting somebody and you come up short, I've seen the Vince McMahon type gifts on Twitter, that's going to be Jeremy Pruitt walking in to meet with Barry Odom. Like, well, have you gotten any of his players yet? Because if you haven't, then I don't know what the strut would be. If anything, this might galvanize the jury. If nobody leaves, they all stay and they say, let's play for us this year. And there's also the scoreboard aspect, and he was a point off, but Barry Odom, he's right. Missouri won 50-17, actually each of the last two seasons. So that's the level that Tennessee's trying to get to. I think it's kind of like a sneaky rivalry that is forming there with Tennessee and Missouri. So it's good for us, I think. But there's the ethical side of it. And if the roles were reversed, I don't think Tennessee would like Missouri doing that at all.
Yep, exactly.
Josh, great stuff as always, man. We appreciate the time. We'll talk with you next week.
Hey, you got it. Thanks a lot, guys.
You got it. Josh Ward, WNML in Knoxville every Friday here on Morning Drive.
That's a great point. If this was Missouri, if this was Dan Mullen calling Tennessee players to come play, Tennessee fans would lose their ever-loving minds.
Uh-huh.
And listen, I'm a capitalist, so I'm all about it. If it's in the rules, you can go get players. Is it worth the bad PR you're getting, being called out, scoreboard by Barry Odom? Josh is right. You better get somebody.
Uh-huh.
'Cause if you don't get somebody, all this has done is build up that image that people have that Jeremy Pruitt doesn't care.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like this whole sticky vibe about how Jeremy Pruitt is what he is. He's sort of abrasive and he doesn't care about you and he doesn't care about the rules and blah, 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 blah. He's not really doing anything wrong here. But if you don't get any players and you get called out by an opposing coach and then he points to the scoreboard and he's got 30 plus points on you, it's not a good look,
no,
at least.
Not at all.
For Jeremy Pruitt.
All right, we'll come back. We're going to get into the game for tomorrow night, the Vols in Kentucky. We'll look at the matchups. How can they win this game at Rupp Arena? And then also, I want to get to the fan perspective of how Rick Barnes is going to be evaluated. We'll get into that next. It's Morning Drive live from Kitchen Notes here on ESPN 102.5 The Game.
You know, the Tennessee Volunteers basketball program, the team this year, is the complete package, right? They've got great size down low. They've got the coaching that's been there forever. They've got tournament experience from last year. They've got great guard play that's efficient. That is what Spring Hill Heating and Cooling is to the heating and cooling world here in Middle Tennessee. They've got great experience. They're built like Tennessee, right? Great experience, nearly two decades in the market. They've got great guard play, right? Ownership, it's locally owned. You can get right to them. The coaching there. You also know that they're going to show up and do a professional job every single time they come to your house. They're going to come to your house. They're coming to my parents or my parents' house next week for the Comfort Club every 6 month checkup to make sure the house is up and running smoothly, to make sure they save my in-laws some money in case something might be looking like it might go wrong. They'll catch it on the front end because you join the Comfort Club and that's what you get. You get checkups every 6 months to make sure that they catch all those little mistakes. They're complete. They're the complete package. They're complete professionals. They will offer you excellent financing options in case of a giant repair, especially if you need new equipment. You can get no interest for 5 years for qualified buyers on new repairs and new equipment. So if you need that big purchase, they got you covered there. They will completely evaluate your house every 6 months and present to you the best possible option for you and your family, both financially and for your home. So they want you to have an efficient home. They want you to have efficient bills and save money and have and live with that peace of mind. Spring Hill Heating and Cooling, it's why my family uses them. It's why you should use them. Locally owned, nearly two decades of experience, the complete package, Spring Hill Heating and Cooling. Check them out. The website, springhillac.com. That's springhillac.com. Make sure you tell them Braden sent you.
Welcome back to the Morning Drive, ESPN 102.5 The Game.
Yeah, I haven't heard this song in a long time.
This feels like a Derek Mason song. You know Mason's off this morning, right, Chase?
Yeah, this is Ricky Bass. He'd be like, drives me crazy.
That was pretty good.
Fine Young Cannonballs?
Yeah.
I have no idea, but my father loved it.
Yeah. What is this called, Chase? Fine something?
It's like the 80s?
Yeah, Fine Young Cannonballs. She drives me crazy.
Yep.
I was listening to 80s on 8 on Sirius XM this morning, and this came on. I was like, okay, I'm gonna drop that.
I'm a Spectrum guy.
Yeah.
Well,
I like Spectrum.
If I'm not listening to 102.9 The Buzz.
Yeah.
Of course.
Okay.
Nashville's rock station.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
They don't need any help.
One quick thing with the Odom Pruitt thing in the conversation and those comments before we get to the basketball.
Do you think it's unethical to be calling players that are not really recruits that are on campus that are seniors?
I mean, I don't know that it's unethical, but I was thinking about this big picture with the way we talked about this earlier in the week about how college football and the free agency and the evolution of the way the sport is trending. I don't know that I'm totally opposed to this or outraged by it, because it's now leading to like this bigger branching out of acquiring talent, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I did the math. There's about 13,000 college football players, and 51 of them were granted early, you know, eligibility to play right away.
So it's a small trend.
So we're talking about, when coaches say free agency, it's a scare tactic.
Right.
It's coaches losing power. And so now this is a little different, right? This is guys who have been on campus, who have 1 year of eligibility left, who have graduated or whatever. You could call a large collection of players. I haven't really seen the bad press. So one of the arguments is, you know, this is not a good look for Jeremy Pruitt. We actually just said that last segment. This isn't a good look if you don't get players. But if you get a couple of guys and you operate within the framework of the rules, I'm not really sure what's unethical about it. It doesn't feel good. It kind of feels slimy. But like Penn State went through a major scandal and lost a dozen players or whatever to a bunch of other schools, and you know, nobody thought anything of that. So I'm not really sure. And the other thing is what does it say about Tennessee's roster that Jeremy Pruitt is so fixated on Missouri players?
Yeah, plucking talent.
I'm not trying to be disrespectful to Missouri. They've done a good job developing talent. They've obviously had a good team the last couple of years, and so certainly they've matched up well against Tennessee. But this to me speaks more about, I don't really think it speaks to Jeremy Pruitt's like ethical compass and like his, I think calling these guys is within the framework of the rules. It's fine. But I do think it says something about how he views his own roster.
Sure.
Which is, oh my gosh, there might be guys on Missouri's team that we could use and make us better right now.
Well, when
that's a scary thought.
When Tennessee's right, they should never be trying to, you know, pry away Missouri recruits and Missouri talent. You should never have to stoop down to, not to disrespect Missouri.
Wait, again, that's a little disrespectful.
But you shouldn't have to fall down to their level of talent.
I would agree.
Yeah. All right, Vols, Kentucky. I do want to get to the coaching angle, but let's get to the matchups within the game itself.
So, I mean, we can go coaching first, though, because I think that's at the top of the list. As much as I think Barnes in the tournament has something to prove, he's had some good runs, but that was a long time ago. It's been 10 years since he made it out of the first weekend. I think Tennessee has an advantage. I don't think I've never thought that highly of Calipari as an X's and O's in-game manager. I don't think he draws up great plays. I think he's a great motivator. I think he's a great team psychologist, because he has to take true freshmen and mold them into a team in a very short period of time, and I think he's actually really good at that. I think he's a great recruiter. I think he's a great CEO. I don't think that he's out-scheming people ever. I've never viewed him as, and I don't think anybody in the industry has viewed him as, a high-level, you know, cerebral X's and O's basketball coach. So I think that's where what makes Tennessee special is how meticulous this team is, how attention to detail-oriented this team is, and how well-coached this team is. That's where I think it starts there, that Barnes is the better coach. Not by much, but schematically on the floor, I think Barnes is a slightly better coach. And even then, Barnes' systems are relatively simple. There's a lot of ISO in the offense.
Okay, a couple of things that you said. I agree with you. There's no doubt about it. Calipari is a better recruiter than he is a tactical X's and O's coach. I think everybody would agree with that. He's definitely a recruiter. He's definitely a motivator. For some reason, when you said that, that triggered Les Miles in my head. Great recruiter, great motivator, but gets outcoached within the framework of the game.
I think he's a far more sophisticated, more polished version of Les Miles.
Okay.
Yes. They both have a national championship because of great players.
Can you truly, and I think Calipari's career win percentage at Kentucky is like
off the charts.
82% or something. Yeah. Can you really be that questionable of an X's and O's coach and still win? Because, look, he's getting the talent. He gets the one and done. We know the route he goes. He doesn't get the guy that stays for 3 or 4 years. But I almost feel like we're almost giving him a little bit of a disrespectful slant.
I would say this about Dabo Swinney. I think.
Really?
I don't think that – yeah, I mean, listen, I've talked to former – I lived in the same building with a former Clemson player that's like, yeah, the guy doesn't draw plays. He's the opposite of Steve Spurrier, right? What makes Dabo Swinney special is this cultural – culture-building leadership, run through a brick wall sort of, I'm going to build a program culture that everyone buys into and pulls in the same direction. Dabo Swinney isn't drawing up plays that are out-scheming people. That's not what he does. And so every – but – when somebody says, I don't think he's a great coach, I think he's a great coach, well, part of coaching is acquiring talent, leadership, motivation, all these things that Coach Cal, I think, does very, very well, and Dabo Swinney does very, very well. But I don't think anyone would say that Dabo Swinney is a high-level schematic coach. So, like, John Beilein to me is
– I think he's the best X's and O's coach
I think, and that's, again, I think – I agree, and to your point, I think John Beilein schematically is one of the smartest, savviest, best coaches in the country. Mm-hmm. And that's the opposite of what John Calipari is. So the guys who can do it both, Nick Saban's of the world, are the ones who are great. Bill Belichick, Coach K at Duke. I mean, there's guys that are that can do both of it, right? And I think part of why – listen, if Coach Cal coaches another 5 or 6 years at Kentucky, which is very reasonable, he's young, he's mm-hmm. in, he looks like he's in great shape. If he coaches for 20 years at Kentucky – and he finishes with one title with that much talent, I think it would be a massive underachievement.
Oh, I would agree.
So at what point do we say the guy should have – I mean, he's won a ton of games. He's got a great resume.
Do you think he's compared to Patino and the standard Patino set for winning?
I don't know how much –
Forget the obvious.
Yeah, no, I know. I don't know how much Patino really counts about anything at this point.
But what Patino did in 96 and then moving forward, it was Tubby Smith in 98.
Tubby won the championship. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's about that necessarily. I think it's about we're in a sort of a new era. The one and done is new era than it was with Patino and Tubby. And you know, frankly, the best NBA players, even though that 96 team was just loaded with superstars,
yeah.
The best NBA players came off of Tubby's team, frankly. Mm-hmm. Was it Tayshaun Prince and Rajon Rondo both came off the Tubby teams, not the Patino teams, the Mash Burns and the Antoine Walker. Like, I guess Antoine Walker played for a while, but
he had a good run.
I never thought he was a good NBA player because I could score 25 points a night if you're going to give me 30 shots.
Yeah.
I think in the new era, with as much talent as Calipari has had, if he coaches for 20 years at Kentucky, which I realize is a long time from now, but if he coaches for 20 years at Kentucky and has one title and it's the year he had Anthony Davis, the best prospect he's ever had other than maybe Derrick Rose or Marcus Camby, I mean, I think that would be an. I think you'd have to argue that he underachieved in his time as the coach. So I think Barnes is the edge here. I think the post matchup is fascinating. PJ Washington and Grant Williams went head to head last year in Knoxville, and as I said to Josh, you know, PJ Washington held when he was on the floor against Grant Williams, he held Grant Williams in 23 minutes to 6 points and 4 rebounds. He has got the ability to match up with Grant Williams, so that's going to be fascinating. I think how Tennessee attacks. On defense, Ashton Hagans is the key because Hagans has turned the ball over a lot. He's not a great shooter. You can sag off of him and let him try to make jumpers. And if he has to shoot the ball, here are the numbers. His last three games before the LSU game, 5 points, 5 assists, 4 turnovers a game. That's not getting it done. And he only had 1 assist against LSU. Now, he had no turnovers against LSU, but 3 assists, 5 turnovers against North Carolina, 5 turnovers against Vandy. He turns the ball over when you press him. So I'd like to see what Rick Barnes does defensively against him. Let him shoot the basketball and make him beat you, because what you don't want is Euro and Johnson outside getting hot shooting, because when they're focused and shooting well, mm-hmm. that's dangerous.
All right, when we come back, the Preds are too good at too many key spots not to win. We'll explain why next here on Morning Drive on ESPN 102.5 The Game.